Hello, and welcome to Dockside, the podcast that helps you save and enjoy the waters you love by sharing clean and safe boating practices. I'm your host, Sarah Kennedy. In this episode, we'll talk with Risa Shimoda,
Jerry Merrill,
and Richard Montgomery, who have played pivotal roles in the history of whitewater boating and the conservation of California rivers. This episode is part of a three-part series in partnership with American Whitewater, a national river conservation nonprofit with a mission to protect and restore America's whitewater rivers and to enhance opportunities to enjoy them safely. All right, let's introduce our guests. First, I'll start with Risa Shimoda, one of the most prolific river stewards, organizers for grassroots advocacy, freestyle paddling, and whitewater park promotion in the history of kayaking in the United States. Say hello, Risa.
Hi, everyone. It's a pleasure to be here.
Up next, we have Jerry Merrill, who is a prominent river explorer and conservationist with many first descents, who also co-founded Friends of the River to help save the Stanislaus River. Say hello, Jerry.
Hi there, everyone.
And last but not least, Richard Montgomery, mathematics professor at UC Santa Cruz, who was the first to paddle the Grand Canyon of the Tuolumne. Say hello, Richard.
Hi. Hi, everyone.
Welcome to the show, everyone. We're so excited to speak with you today about the history of whitewater boating. Let's get started. First, let's talk about the history of whitewater boating. When and why did you become involved in the sport of whitewater paddling? We'll start with you, Risa.
Well, thanks again for this opportunity. And I wouldn't say that my start was the start of whitewater boating. It started a little bit before I started. But it was in the late 70s, and I was out of college. I was living and working as an engineer in Cincinnati, Ohio, and I didn't know anyone except my cubicle mates. And one of them was a recently widowed, enthusiastic 55-year-old fellow who on Friday, all he would talk about was kayaking. And then on Monday morning, all he would talk about was where he went kayaking. And after he attempted to introduce me to people, because I didn't know anyone, through square dancing for singles, parents without partners, his Methodist church, and a bunch of other organizations, he dragged me to a pool session in Hamilton County, Ohio, where I met, you know, a number of people. I was fascinated with this rolling business. And after we finished the pool session, I went to see a movie called Fast and Clean. And I was fascinated by it. I loved the people. And the next day I bought a paddle and a life jacket and a helmet and whatever else I needed, and kayaked probably every weekend thereafter for about 5 years, except for Christmas and New Year's. So it was the people and the unusual nature of their interests that was just kind of breathtaking for me. So I just started and never looked back.
Thank you. And how about you, Jerry?
Well, I started kayaking back in the Pleistocene, and we used rock kayaks. No, just kidding. But I did start in summer camp when I was barely a teenager. We went out on a river in Michigan called the Rouge River, went by the Ford plant. And it was supposed to be a nice, gentle little flat water, you know, Grumman canoe thing on the absolutely flat Rouge River. But it turned out there had been the remnants of a hurricane that had come through, and the river was really high, way higher than the counselors ever contemplated. It actually had a few little rapids running through trees, and it just blew me away. It was so much fun, and that was it. So I started canoeing and never looked back.
Awesome. And last but not least, how about you, Richard?
I got started in 1972. I just wanted to comment about Risa, the Fast and Clean. They're redoing that movie, I heard. I got started in 72. It was a weird, you're going to have to stop me if I talk too much about it. I had a crush on a girl, and I was 15. I thought I would just paddle. I didn't think driving was a good way to go, so I was just going to paddle up to Vancouver to see her, but I didn't know how to kayak. So I forgot the girl's name, but I got into kayaking in the San Francisco Bay. I would paddle out there in a little wood canvas boat. And I had read about Eskimos and Eskimo rolling. And I was trying to Eskimo roll this canvas kayak with no spray skirt. And it was at the where the Berkeley Sailing Club is. And a man saw me and he basically said, there's a better way. And he told me about the Sierra Club River touring section, which met in Oakland. So I went to a meeting there before I was 16, and they had a film of people boating, I think Glenwood Canyon in Colorado. And it just completely blew me away. I just had to do that. I remember the people in the film had no helmets, they just had spray skirts, and they just looked like centaurs going down the big the big waves. So I slowly got into it. Back then you built your own boat, you built everything. So and there was a lot of support through the Sierra Club River touring section. So that was my start. My first river was when I was 16, on my 16th birthday. The McCullumney, the Electra run of the McCullumney, still a beginner run here.
Amazing. So what are some of your favorite California rivers or even rivers in United States? We'll start with you, Jerry.
Well, I guess I have a special affinity to the Tuolumne, having worked on it both as a conservationist and, you know, frequent river runner of the Tuolumne. I've run it almost every year for probably 50 years or something like that. And so it's special. Running the Grand Canyon is almost a unique experience. And I think many, many kayakers and rafters have done that at least once. I've done it three times. But there are so many gorgeous rivers in California, it's impossible to put them in order. The Smith, the South Yuba, the North Fork American are just virtually pristine and remarkable. So I hate to play favorites.
How about you, Richard?
Me? You know, kind of the short answer is whatever river I'm on. I live in Santa Cruz and we have one river in town and it runs between 2 and 60 days a year. And so I ran it twice this week. It's only a mile and a half long, but I just love being on rivers. I love being on rivers. If I had to make a grand river, you know, list, I suppose it would be the Middle Fork of the Feather and the Tuolumne would be my, yeah. Middle Fork of the Feather and the Tuolumne, but all the Sierra rivers. Yeah, I just love being on rivers.
Thank you. And how about you, Risa?
No, I haven't lived in California since college as a paddler, but I've visited many times. I've had opportunities to do like a week at a time or a long weekend. And I would say if I just woke up and said, what are my most vivid images of being in California paddling? For sure, two for different reasons. One is on the Middle Fork Feather, the Ball Rock Canyon. That's just an incomparable run, and with the technical aspects and the granite and what it means to be there and so forth, and the middle of a really wonderful national forest. And then the other, for quite different reasons, South Fork American, the community that is there. That has grown up and sustains. I've been there, you know, a number of times over many years, and just recently, a year and a half ago, at Halloween time, where the whole town goes all in for Halloween, and it's just extraordinary because the river is not just a part of some people's recreation. You know, it's a thread in everyone's life there, and that's quite something that doesn't always happen, but it's really embedded in the whole. Community. So both for different reasons.
Thank you. And how have you seen whitewater craft and equipment change since you began paddling? Richard, we'll start with you.
Well, the big change was going from fiberglass to plastic. It made them boats much more durable. And then they got much shorter. things start to become much easier. The hard rapids from when I started, I remember distinctly switching from T slalom to a free fall on Cherry Creek on the upper part of the Tuolumne. Beth Rippins told me to upgrade, and it became a class easier just from switching the boats. So it went through a big lot of changes, and now it feels like it's in a period where they're kind of realizing that boats got too short, or maybe make them a little longer, and it seems like it's stabilizing now.
Great, thank you. And Risa, how about you?
Yeah, well, when I started, people were still making their boats, but it became less and less mandatory. So I think the move to plastic was huge, absolutely huge. I worked for Perception Kayaks for a while, whose founder really instituted the mass production in a way, but distribution. There weren't retail stores where you could buy a kayak, you know, easily before the late 70s, I guess. You sort of have to know the club. You had to figure out who knew what and go to somebody's, you know, backyard or garage to find a boat to buy. And, you know, thereafter it got, you know, much easier. The technology has changed to where when I was working at Perception, we went from boats that would break really easily to boats that could almost bounce if you dropped them off a 10-foot drop. So the material has gotten better. The outfitting used to be just empty shells, and you kind of put whatever you could in there to jam yourself in so you wouldn't fall out. And now they're very fancy and pretty darn adjustable, you know, so you can be big or little or long legs or short legs, and you should be able to find a boat. And then finally, being able to size a boat to your body has changed a lot. There used to be one model, one size, and Richard and I would be asked to go in the same boat and try to make them work. And it might be a little short for him, and I might be falling out of it. So that all that like accommodation for different types of people have changed a lot. And then I'll just mention, because this is my favorite kind of kayaking, the design for specific paddling has evolved in certain corners of the sport, I would say. So my favorite paddling is squirt boating. And one of the things that you're supposed to attempt to do is go underwater, stay underwater for periods of time. And you can only do that if your boat doesn't float. If it floats, it's not so good because you won't be able to go underwater. So my boat, it has all these little curves in it to take out all the voids in the air. And if you're familiar with like an off-the-rack boat, not a play boat, but a regular river running boat, might be 50 gallons in size, 40, 50, something like that. So my squirt boat is 13 gallons. So it's really teeny weeny and flat, but it's for a specific purpose. It fits me, and it's, you know, so it's suited to me. So the technology awareness of, dynamics, hydrodynamics, has changed, and materials and accommodation of different sizes. So lots has changed.
And how about you, Jerry?
Well, for me, the transition from Grumman aluminum canoes to a homemade fiberglass boat was pretty big, because when I was at Penn State, I had a Grumman that I bought in upstate New York at the end of the season. That's what you did. It was, I think, $50. And then I put an aluminum deck on it. Weighed about 90 pounds, and it was a little hard to get on and off the car. And so that was whitewater boating in Pennsylvania back in the 60s. And fiberglass boats were just coming in. People were starting to make their own in their basement. And so I did that for quite a while. By the way, at one point, Al Chase and I made a boat that had a pigment that would fluoresce. And so we brought it into the river touring section one night, turned off all the lights, and the boat glowed in the dark. That was a very cool boat, I must say. I agree with what everyone else has said about moving to plastic, and you don't have to breathe methyl ethyl ketone a lot, which is really a nice break to get away from that. But I think the other thing is the other gear has changed a lot. When I first started boating, you wore a wetsuit which worked okay. You got a little cold if you went in the water, but very cumbersome. The switch to dry suits just opened up winter boating like almost nothing else. Everybody, when you go out winter boating now, just about has a dry suit, and that really made a huge difference. And the other thing I'll say, because we shouldn't ignore our rafting friends, was the switch from the old bucket boats, which were solid floors, to self-bailing rafts, which just revolutionized rafting. And so the gear has just come a long, long way.
Thank you. And how does paddling in California differ from paddling in other regions? Risa, would you like to go first?
Sure. I think there's more that's similar than dissimilar. When you are in a community of paddlers, when you meet the paddlers who paddle there, what might vary is if you're going with your own group and you're going to, and you find yourself in a group of people who are from there, I think the amount of information that they use for guiding their trips might vary a little bit. But I think there's more that's similar than there's dissimilar, honestly. The only thing that might be different is in where they're not so much by state or, you know, in California versus others, but where there's a larger or denser population of boaters near a place where you're going. So in one extreme in North Carolina, there's a Green River. That's a challenging river, but it's short. It's minutes off the interstate, and it's near Asheville, which has lots of kayakers in it, partly because of that. So on any day, you could do a pickup trip with a stranger on a class 5 river at lunchtime. You know, so that's just a dynamic that's specific to that area, but it's not so much that it's in North Carolina. You know, it's more than the configuration of the river, the access, the number of people who are around. So the resources, you could go to the gas station and ask the guy or the gal where to put it into the green is, and they could tell you, you know, in great detail. So I would say that more than the state.
Thank you. Okay. And Jerry?
Well, California is really big. So if you want to, let's go run the Smith. Okay, that's a 7-hour drive from the Bay Area, and heaven help you if you live in LA or San Diego. So, but that's just a geographical quirk, because if you want to go run the Yacht and you live in, you know, Vermont, you're still going to have a similar drive. I think the biggest difference in California and why I stayed here after grad school is the weather. Let's face it, winter boating here is what we would call spring boating in Pennsylvania. You can boat here any time of the year, especially if you have a dry suit. And in fact, there's certain rivers, especially on the North Coast, where you pretty much only run them in the winter because that's when they flow. And so it's just a much friendlier climate to boating, especially than in the Midwest or the Northeast, where you kind of wait for late March and then you go, I wonder how much ice there is on the river. We used to have that as a challenge in Pennsylvania.
And Richard?
That was an interesting question. I've boated in, I lived in Massachusetts for 2 years and boated there. And I boated in Colorado and Idaho, but just passing through. Lived in Oregon for 6 months. I guess I'm going to agree with both the previous speakers. Once you get in to meet boaters, it's kind of the same feeling. I'll never forget my first trip in Massachusetts, leaving Somerville in a blizzard. I just couldn't believe it. And that's the first time I ever saw a dry suit. I remember that woman taking a swim. And yeah, it was a big deal to see how good dry suits were. So yeah, it's a lot warmer here than typical boating back east. When I think of the communities I know boating, I'd say the one that feels the most different is around Potomac, the Washington, D.C., where they have a real heavy race scene. And the boaters I know that started there, the typically slalom racers, they're really technically quite good and started, you know, boated every day. What else? Yeah. And then of course, there's the Grand Canyon, which is a culture unto itself because of the people who are making a living boating.
Wow.
Yeah.
I'm going a little off script here, but there may be people listening that don't know anything about river running. Can one of you explain like the class system and difficulties of rivers and how that's decided or how the levels are decided or named?
Well, go ahead.
Well, there's two systems. One is sort of the American whitewater system, class one to six. Class one is just flat moving water. And then the rapids get harder and harder until you get to class six, which almost no one runs. It's a risk to life and limb. Then there's the Grand Canyon system where they rate the rapids one to 10. And it's the same idea, only more smaller gradations, essentially.
Got it. Thank you.
I'm gonna chime in here. Yes, when you get to the, is that okay?
Yes, of course.
When you, like class one for most people is flat, class two is some rapids. Class three is like intermediate beginner stuff. Class four is starting to get more serious consequences if you swim. Class five is like really serious if you screw up. And the way my friends and I always did things, if class six gets boated more than a few times, then it's demoted to class five. Class six is stuff that kills you if you run it. That's the way we did it. And then the gray, there's a lot of gray zone in four and five. You kind of have to know who you're boating with. There's people who would say one person would call it an easy class four and another person would call it a hard class five. So you need, when you get to the higher end, you have to have a sense of who it is you're boating with. That's my take on the system.
Yeah, I'd also add that there are classifications for rapids, which are exactly what these guys have said. And then sometimes there's sort of an application of the difficulty of a run, which might incorporate its access. So if you're in a river that has class four rapids, but it's extremely remote and rescue is extremely challenging, you might, you know, bump up your assessment or your description of the day or the trip.
Thank you. So early whitewater boating became intermarried with the environmentalism movement, river conservation, and a wave of big dam proposals. Can you talk about your journey from recreationalist to conservationalist? Jerry, can you go first?
Sure. When I first started boating, we didn't really think about environmental problems too much. But in Pennsylvania, we really saw the impact of mining, because rivers would run literally red. And so you couldn't help but notice that river was not in a healthy condition. When I came to California in 1967, it was the height of the era of dam building. And it was a direct threat to whitewater recreation. The big fight at the time was the New Maloney's Dam and the Stanislaus River. And we had a petition drive to try to stop that, and then an actual ballot measure and initiative to try to stop it. Unfortunately, wasn't successful. But the boaters, kayakers and rafters, and the professional rafting companies, we don't want to discount them, all became involved to a lesser or greater extent in the effort to get the signatures for the initiative, campaign for it, donate money to it, and so on. I will say there's kind of two classes of boaters. There's those who really get it and get very involved in conservation issues. And then, frankly, there's people who just like to go out river running and don't really want to get involved in politics, so they don't. But that's true of almost any activity, so that's kind of what still happens.
Richard, how about you?
When I was 19, I moved up to work on the Stanislaus River, which is the one Jerry just talked about. A little earlier that year, I joined up with this campaign to get this Prop 17 on the ballot. So I was very involved in the beginning of that. I was young. I was a total hippie. I went barefoot all the time. So it wasn't great for politicking. But I was there when Marc Dubois chained himself to try to stop the dam. And I kind of watched all the different elements of the community It really changed my life. I would have probably still be living up there if that, I wouldn't have been a math professor. I had to figure out a plan B. This river was destroyed and I knew it very well. I probably knew it better than any river. So it was heartbreak and it changed my life. I did not go full force into conservation. I have huge respect for people who kind of devote a big chunk of their life to it, like Jerry has. But I give money and, you know, go to events. I don't knock on doors. I don't know how to do policy, but I have huge respect for people who do.
Thank you. And Risa?
Well, I when I started kayaking, my early goals were to not die when I was and learn how to roll and to get a ride to the next weekend's trip. And that was really my focus because I had a regular day job. And it took a while. And after a little while, one place where I did go 50 weekends in a row was the Ocoee River in Tennessee. And the reason why I went with friends was because the flume for the power plant, the TVA plan, was broken. So there was a lot of work in the background that, of course, I didn't know. I was driving from Cincinnati. I didn't know why or who was behind it or what they were trying to do to fix it. I just knew that this river, something was broken and the river was running. So I just, for the longest time, I just enjoyed that. And it wasn't until spending more time and being there that I realized that people have to work in order for water to flow. When there's a hydropower dams, it doesn't just automatically go whenever you want it to. So it took a little while for me to realize that there needed to be work done in order for me to enjoy my hobby. Along the way, because my introduction to the sport was through a Sierra Club, a big one. It wasn't quite as big as the Loma Prieta one at Richards, but it was very active. So I got involved in like river cleanup, things like that. But then just one other step, because I was pretty clueless, I think, still at this time. One other step was when I moved to New Jersey and met a fellow named Pete Skinner, who was adamant about helping rivers. He's adamant about getting involved in the relicensing process. And he made me do things like survey people and write reports and write letters. And I was still pretty clueless, but I started to become aware of that there were elements that were not helping paddlers enjoy rivers that were free-flowing. It really took a little while for me to understand that dams stop a river in order to make power and deprive the reach below it of water. As simple as that is, it's not just obviously clear when you're 22 or 23 and you're hoping to make your roll. I mean, so there was a little bit of a leap, but I'd say that many of the people who I'd subsequently met as volunteers for American Whitewater, they got it quicker than I did, but you can't spend too much time on rivers without realizing that they're vulnerable. All it really takes is seeing a piece of trash floating in or seeing an outfall and imagining what gross stuff is coming out of it. So I think that the immersion in the sport and realizing what's around you, enjoying what you're doing, and then realizing that it can be threatened like any day of the year. You know, it's kind of like a switch that turned on for me.
What changes do you see in a river when a dam is built? You know, Jerry?
Turns into a lake.
Yeah. And
yeah, there's no more river.
Environmentally, what are the impacts to the river below and just in the area?
Well, you know, when a dam is built, the river upstream does, as Richard said, turns into a lake, which can be greatly fluctuating. The river water level go up and down a lot. The fish species totally change from trout and riverine species to, you know, lacustrine species. The temperature changes a lot. When you go down a river like the Tuolumne, as you get to the reservoir, you instantly notice, if you pass the thermocline, how much warmer it is. So that affects the river downstream because warm water can be let out. It's the most devastating change you can possibly imagine. Although an equally bad change can be when the river is dammed up and then the water is diverted into a downstream power plant, that can dry up the river below for many miles. So you can have a double impact from a dam being built.
Wow. So how have you seen the culture within the sport change during your time boating? Richard, start with you.
Oh, wow. So when I started, it was all club boating and racing was more important. And there were one of the big events that each year, there were several races put on, there were training camps. The club scene has pretty much disappeared here. There's the Chico Paddler, what's it called? Paddler Head or something. There's a few that are around, but not many. So it's groups of small, it's little small groups that somehow find each other, I guess often through things like, what's it called, boater talk. But what else? Let's see. Other changes, there was a period where there was that kind of people trying to be professional boaters, I guess kind of the mid-90s to mid-2000s. There was a period of time where there were people who were making some kind of a living, doing very, you know, taking pictures of themselves and doing hard runs. So that was an interesting period. It seems like that's, we're kind of at the end of that. There's not too many people left doing that. What else? Yeah, the whole playboat, the rodeo and the whole playboat thing, that was an interesting phase. It's still going on. Yeah, those are some of the changes. I don't know what else to say about that one. I might want to circle back to the rivers, but you know how rivers change after dams. But
yeah, go ahead. Yeah, go for it.
Yeah, so I had a friend who lived on the Stanislaus River. It's Gard Dubois, Marc Dubois' brother, and I would walk there. He lived in a treehouse along the river, and it was just exquisitely beautiful. It was near a big fig tree that was down there. And we walked down again. He had done it in like maybe 2012. We walked to where he knew the spot was, and he called it the death zone. He'd been there before, and it looked completely devastated. It was just talus, bare talus, really hot, no trees because of this fluctuation of the water. And you know what did we see down there? We saw in about 3 hours down there one motorboat go by. It was just, yeah, it's like this huge scale murder that's going on when you build a dam. And you don't really know it unless you've been there before and after, the extent of the devastation.
Thank you.
Yeah, that's what I wanted to say about that.
Thank you. Risa, do you have anything to add about the dams?
I don't have anything to add about the dams. These guys have said it really well.
And do you have, our last question was, how has the culture changed within the sport during your time boating?
Well, culture has changed. And part of it is how information sharing has changed. You know, in the club area, like Richard, well, all of us grew up in, you had to find a group of people to make your boat, tell you what to do, teach you where to learn, tell you how to do this sport, how to navigate and so forth, how to be safe, and how to develop a group, a posse that you could go with and continue to learn and explore. And now when you can look up all of the above, you know, all of the above, you can just look it up. So there's both this preponderance of information. It's not always obvious how to sift it, so to find out what's perfect for you, not, you know, joining a club, you sort of figure out what's best for you, you know, when you meet people. I wouldn't say there's more pressure on individuals, but I'd say there's more possibility to pursue a path that might not be so great, either paddling a river that's too hard for you, or making some assumptions about something, about the sport or your equipment, like buying a boat off of Craigslist and realizing it's for someone that's like 300 pounds, you know? So some of them, there's no consequence. But so the exposure is better. And then I'll just share this. A friend of mine from high school who knows I like kayaking just sent me a video last night. She's in France with her husband, and she was watching people surf in Bordeaux or something. And she said, Risa, they're doing kayaking, so we're thinking about you. And those people are doing something that is something I would probably never do, but it was kayaking. So in a way, you know, the exposure of the sport being something that's healthy and fun and in nature is good. And there's the way that someone is asked, I guess, or should be expected to make decisions for themselves on how to do that fun is in some ways easier, in some ways harder. So it is quite different. But in terms of meeting a person who you'd like to go paddling that day, the same. Yeah, they're the same kind of people.
What about women in whitewater boating? How is women getting into, has that changed?
It's changed a lot from, you know, a lot of my first early trips. I was the only one for sure. You know, me and like 8 people or me and 15 guys or something. There are a lot more opportunities for women, proactive opportunities with classes, you know, organizations that do women's classes or appeal to women specifically. Equipment has gotten a lot better, not perfect, but a lot better. And there are many women now who are avid paddlers, river paddlers. And, you know, the staff on AW is a perfect example. So I think that's changed in a good way. It's still kind of a boys club, I would say. But it's way better, way, way, way better. And I would hope so. I started in 1979, you'd hope it'd be better. But it is, I'm very hopeful. And the women boaters who are experienced in teaching others are awesome.
Thank you.
The change in culture is, it's the same kind of people boating now, pretty much, who boated, or they have to be somewhat athletic. I find that, frankly, there's a higher level of education among whitewater boaters, especially because a lot of it came out of universities, and that's still the case. But the biggest change is that they aren't there at all. I find that whitewater boating is declining, maybe sort of stabilizing, but declining a lot. For example, in the old days on the South Fork of the American River, there's a rapid called First Threat. And when Reese's company, Perception, came out with the Dancer, that was sort of the classic early whitewater boat, you would go to this rapid and you would see 10, 15, 18 dancers, all dancers, trying to surf this particular rapid and just play in it. Now, when I go by First Threat, if there's one boat there, it's a shock. Now, and the other thing is, I did a river trip on Cache Creek last summer, and I was thinking as we went under one of the bridges on the river that if anyone had been there, they would have thought that it was an escape from an assisted living facility, because the boaters were all at least 65 and some 80. And while there are still young boaters around, not nearly as many. And that's true of kayaking. It's really true of rafting. It used to be when you went to the South Fork of the American and you went out at the takeout in sort of the early 2000s or 90s or whatever, you would see $1 million worth of rafts going up to the takeout after running the river. Now, you might see 2 or 3 rafts, even on a weekend, and they're all piloted by grizzled veterans. And so there was a big decline in whitewater boating. I think it's sort of stabilized now, and there are younger boaters coming in for sure, and places like Eureka, especially where there's a university around. But I asked a good friend of mine who runs the California Canoe and Kayak why he thought that was. And he said, it's screens. He said, younger people now are stuck to their screens and they don't want to invest the time it takes to learn to boat. No one learns to boat in a weekend or even in a few months. And so they just don't want to invest the time. And it's kind of sad. I hope the people listening to this podcast decide to go to one of the very good kayaking schools we have here in California and learn to boat. You'll love it.
That's what I did. I mean, I grew up as a surfer and fell in love with whitewater boating. And it is kind of a hard community from Southern California to get into. We didn't know anyone, but, you know, it's my passion now. And I think many people, once you try it, you get hooked. You're right. So do you all have something or anything to add for seasoned whitewater boaters and then also for folks out there just getting into the sport? Risa, we'll start with you.
I think, well, that I appreciate the community. We all tend to get into our little posses and spend most time with them. And if you, you know, if you woke up in somebody else's group, you find that those people are pretty awesome. So I just say appreciate each other. We need each other on the river. You certainly need each other for safety as well as, you know, the fun of camaraderie. I'm thinking about Jerry's comment about investment. And I think that if there's fewer numbers, it's because of that, because it does take time. And if you see somebody who's good and then you get frustrated because you can't be good tomorrow, then you might quit or, you know, get disappointed. But that it's worth investing the time because there's nothing like, you know, being able to continue to do what you do on some place that's remote or some even a place that's new to you. And that would be the final thing is there are thousands of rivers and no one here or in the audience has been on all of them. And if you can look for one that you've not been on, absolutely guarantee, difficulty aside, that you'll discover something that's cool because there's just too much out there not to.
Thank you. Jerry?
Well, I guess my message to people who are boaters is now encourage younger boaters to get into it. Teach them how to do it or get them to go to a school and encourage them to come on your trips. Be willing to downgrade one of your trips from a class 4 to a class 2 or whatever to let younger boaters learn how to do it. What Risa said is once people get hooked, they'll stay with it, often for life. As I said, a lot of boaters are in their 60s and 70s and still boating, even 80s. And so I think it's the burden is on us who are boaters to get younger people to get involved in the sport. And it will benefit river conservation because they will become activists to some extent. And we'll get a benefit out of that.
Thank you. And Richard?
Messages. Oh, my gosh. Yeah, there's nothing like being on a river. I hope everybody in the audience gets to get on a river. I have 2 grandkids, and I'm trying to get them both to swim. That's been a while. When you're getting someone, maybe I'll just share about my own mistakes. I tried to get my brother into it. I tried to get both my daughters. And I had a very hard time letting go of what Jerry was talking about. I wanted to be on running hard stuff. And that is not a good way to start people off. I scared one of my daughters off. The other one got to love it. You just have to be gentle with people when you're starting. I'm going to talk a little bit about something I missed about the culture, if that's okay. Is that okay? Yeah, so I had taken notes, and it was I was writing about somebody, Noria from France, recently ran this rapid on Bald Rock Canyon that I thought would never be run. We called it Atom Bomb Falls. And I had really interesting emotions around it, but after talking to a bunch of boaters, I realized that one of the reasons people are able to do this is they have drones. So people can scout rapid with drones.
Oh my God.
So I just was real, you know, there's things that have changed. So YouTube, people run, you know, with the GoPro, they run rapids. You can kind of get a sense of the rapid with YouTube. We didn't have that. Drones for scouting, and then the spot, you know, it used to be if you were out in the middle of nowhere and screwed up, that was it. You had to get out on your own, but now you have these emergency buttons you can hit, huh? So that's a big change that's just circling back to the culture, technology and culture question. And it was a real pleasure to do this. Thank you for arranging it. And I'm impressed that you drive all the way from Southern California to go boating.
So. Well, thank you all. Thank you, Risa, Jerry, Richard, for your time today. Thank you to everyone out there listening. Please plan to tune in to our future episodes, and happy boating. This podcast was brought to you by California State Parks and the California Coastal Commission.